This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
This is The Informer, Australia's only LGBTIQ+ national news and current affairs show. Proudly sponsored by KHQ Lawyers. Passionate about being the best.
Earlier today, I spoke with Toby Halligan and asked him if this is indeed the weirdest week in Australian politics. And here's his answer.
Then I think one of the strangest, like this week, but really the last 2 months have, I think, been some of the strangest I remember ever seeing in Australian politics. For a start, I don't remember like this much international attention being given to Australia. For example, I think it's $140 million now that's been raised in charity kind of donations, a lot of that driven by a comedian, Celeste Barber, mm-hmm. who's raised $47 million. Like the groundswell of, for all the focus on the division and the different ways the government has made mistakes, and those are important, like it's been quite remarkable how quickly a lot of the world has responded, and the nature of like those outpourings as well. Whether this is kind of seen as a watershed moment, I guess remains to be seen in terms of the climate change debate. But I think the combination of the fact that Australia is an English-speaking country, because there have been climate change-driven disasters in a range of countries. Mm-hmm. But I think the fact that Australia is an English-speaking country, that it's familiar or is at least on the radar for much of the English-speaking world and much of the Western world in general, has meant that the attention that the fires have gotten has, I think, both put a degree of pressure on the government that even frankly, like a conservative government that has just resisted quite astonishing amounts of pressure to act on climate change thus far, you wonder whether it might not have crossed, to use an old Roman kind of river reference, of sorts. And I think what's also changed is that Scott Morrison, after the election, I think, was riding high and was seen as, you know, a bit of a mastermind in terms of for winning the federal election and as a strategist. And I think that definitively has ended during this period. You know, there is talk on social media that may well not lead anywhere, that, you know, that there might be pressure for him to move on. I don't think that'll happen. But certainly I don't think he will be able to continue to pursue agendas that are clearly divorced from community expectations. Like towards the end of last year, really, there was a couple of weeks where the religious discrimination bill, the ensuring integrity bill, which is targeting the union movement, neither of which are bills, legislation that are actually of particular importance to the overwhelming majority of Australians. Like I think there are very strong cases to be made. They will be detrimental overall, but I don't think anyone in the government could seriously ask that there has been a groundswell, you know, a genuine community groundswell pushing for that legislation, whereas now there will be a lot of pressure to demonstrate that the government is taking what I think will be seen as an iconic disaster seriously. But overall, like one of my reflections is that what this disaster has actually demonstrated is that for all the criticism of Scott Morrison and the different kinds of responses, Australia is actually the best prepared country in the world to respond to a disaster like this. Australia is comparatively very, very wealthy. Mm-hmm. We have a very long history of dealing with bushfires. We've had major disasters within recent memory that mean that public service departments and firefighting authorities have been cognizant of, you know, the importance to update procedures and maintain good communications. We have a very well-informed public who have the resources to, you know, escape if they have to. And it's not been enough. The federal government's definitely mismanaged a lot of things. They could have called the army in earlier. They could have purchased more planes. For example, water bombers and all of these things were raised long, you know, many, many months ago by ex-firefighting chiefs and other people.
Yeah.
But, like, the reality is, I think, while it's easy to shoot blame home to the Morrison government for how they've handled it, the scale of this disaster, it's actually happened in a country that was very well prepared to deal with it. And it is still completely overwhelmed, you know, not just the authorities in one particular jurisdiction, you know, Kangaroo Island, Tasmania, West Australia and South Australia. Like, it has been a national crisis. It's part of the reason why all the debates over fuel load and hazard reduction and land management are, they really are a sideshow, because I think that there is a case to be made that, and I'm sure they will in future years, there is more fuel reduction to be done and land management to be done. But the suggestion that, you know, greenies or environmentalists were stopping people from doing things is a lie. That's been rubbished by multiple firefighting chiefs and the people who are on the ground doing this work across the board.
Yeah.
That is nonetheless a lie that's been perpetuated by News Corp and by Twitter botnets that have been identified by a number of researchers as operating to push a variety of misinformation.
But why? What reason do they possibly have?
To reduce the pressure on the Prime Minister and to move the debate away from climate change. The best way to understand why people might be pushing an agenda of that kind is to quote Deep Throat from the Nixonian era,
Mark
from the Watergate
Felt.
Era.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, follow the money. And if you follow the money, then there are a number of people in Australia and overseas who have billions and billions of dollars invested in coal mines, in energy generation that relies on fossil fuels. Some of them are new investments. They are just opening up. And they have been funneling money into a range of organisations. The Institute of Public Affairs is one of them, one of the most prominent, but there are a number of other climate-denying organisations. And they have also been part of a coordinated effort that operates internationally. And this has been documented pretty well. But basically, there's a number of right-wing campaigners who worked on the Trump campaign, on Brexit, on a range of other campaigns. And they have a few playbooks that they now use and they roll out. And one of them is to create false narratives that are driven on social media, because they know that journalists and conservative news outlets in particular will quote tweets. They will not check, you know, when the Twitter account was created or whether it has any real followers or anything like that.
Yeah.
And that will be used to create a false sense of a narrative within the community. And that's both useful from the point of view of creating news content, basically, but it also creates pressure on conservative politicians who, many of whom, like, I actually don't think it's useful to be partisan about some of this stuff. Yeah, there are plenty of conservatives who do believe in climate change and do believe that we need to act, but have been paralysed by a narrow subset of the conservative movement who are in the pocket of, that they are just in the pocket of these big organisations. And it sounds conspiratorial, but it's been tracked very, very directly and clearly.
Yeah.
You know, Gina Rinehart gives money to these organisations actively. She released a statement yesterday. Celeste Barber, the comedian I was talking about before, had a crack at Gina Rinehart on Twitter saying, hey, what are you doing with your money? If you're in Hawaii, I'll come over and flick an effing table or something like that. And Rinehart's spokesperson, very funny, responded by saying, you know, it's so important that we don't allow us to respond, we focus on the real causes and don't get distracted by climate change. It's really amazing, right? You couldn't
write
it,
And
also, one of the things she flagged was that part of the causes of this disaster has been the refusal to build dams. That has nothing at all to do with fighting fires. Dams don't – that has literally nothing of any kind to do with fighting fires.
And you can't really have an effective dam if you have no water.
No, this is the thing, and these groups and these people actually live in their own bubble as well. There is a kind of a News Corp, Sky Up Late, sections of the talk back market bubble. Those sections of the media reinforce one another. They have some ardent fans who are real people and who believe what they're saying. And so there are definitely some real people on Twitter and social media who push these conspiracies.
Mm.
But there is serious money that is devoted to misinformation.
Well, moving from News Corp to some of the state responses, I saw that Sherry Markson has been talking about how the New South Wales state government actually turned down federal money at some point and federal assistance for the fires, which has been roundly denounced as not true by the New South Wales state government.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And look, I think it'll come out. I imagine there will be a lot of FOIs. There will be a Royal Commission into what's happened here.
Yeah.
And be interesting to see the scope of that Royal Commission's powers. One thing that's worth always being aware of is that Royal Commissions, as a general rule, are a political tactic to postpone pressure for mm-hmm. governments to do things, to deal with difficult problems, or to postpone debating those difficult problems.
And a really good example of that is the aged care inquiries and Royal Commissions, and that I think Absolutely. You uncovered that there were how many over how many years?
Oh, like there's been one a year, basically. Like, you know, in the last 20 years, there have been 20. It may not have been exactly one a year, but the Aged Care Royal Commission delivered an interim report that mm-hmm. was absolutely scathing of the government for the industry and the government.
Yeah.
One part of that was that there's been a massive under-delivery of at-home care packages that allow people to basically stay at home. Mm-hmm. The government indicated they were massively increasing those packages and they were going to flow out. It turned out recently, this was quietly acknowledged, that they'd fallen short by 100,000. They had not solved the problem, and they'd simply ignored the Royal Commission, it appears. The government's also moving to outsource a whole range of services within the aged care sector, when that's something the Royal Commission specifically flagged as a massive problem with the industry. So, but as part of that Royal Commission, we may well find that many of the claims that have been made regarding the federal government and the New South Wales government, the elements of them turn out to be true or untrue. It's hard to say presently.
Mm-hmm.
Sherry Markson is, I think, respected as a journalist at News Corp. Like, that sounds like an odd thing to say, but there are frankly a lot of commentators there who are openly, you know, openly partisan and pass themselves off as conducting themselves in journalistic ways. I think she has a solid reputation as a journalist, but I think it's fair to say she is seen as relatively partisan. And I wonder whether or not, as well, she's quoting sources who have told her that too.
Yes.
And there are solid reasons that people within Scott Morrison's camp, and in particular within his office, which is the source of a lot of those allegations about the New South Wales government, mm-hmm. have for distracting from what's happened. But I certainly think there are questions to answer about when those requests were made, given the scale of the disaster on the South Coast.
Yeah. So moving to the Victorian government, we're seeing a really different response here. And, you know, looking back to 2009, Daniel Andrews was the Minister for Health and Lisa Neville was, I think, the Minister for Aging at that point. So they were both cabinet ministers and have seen something sort of like this once before. And Victoria had a significant amount of reform following the Royal Commission. And, you know, things seem to be working a bit better. But, you know, the conditions are still unprecedented. I mean, we've never seen people evacuated by boat from a town on this scale. You know, maybe one or two people in a flood, but, you know, several thousand?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like the scale of it really is pretty astonishing. And the pictures from Mallacoota and the videos, I think, were something that actually really landed overseas as well, because it looked like hell. I actually know Mallacoota quite well. I spent a lot of time there as a kid. It was a place that we used to holiday quite a lot, and it was very hard. I think, you know, at one point, people in Mallacoota and Batemans Bay simultaneously in those locations are separated by thousands of kilometres, were waiting on the foreshores of their respective bodies of water, waiting for instructions from the CFA to dip under as the fire approached to ensure people weren't killed by the radial heat.
Yeah.
So But I think that's a sign. I think what you were saying before is right, that the Victorian government has, I think, handled it in a pretty responsible way. It's just, I think, been clear that a number of the lessons from Black Saturday have been absorbed both by the CFA, by, you know, various departments that help handle these kinds of disasters, and by the government. I think Dan Andrews has – I actually think Anastasia Palaszczuk has handled quite a lot of this disaster relatively well. Mm-hmm. Her emergency services minister, David Elliott, made just a bizarre decision to go on holiday to Europe.
Are you talking about Gladys Berejiklian?
Sorry, I
New
think
South
Gladys
Wales?
No. Okay. What I'm saying is I think she's also actually handled the disaster relatively well.
Right.
They are both models for how Scott Morrison could easily have handled things, you know, in quite a different way. Like the Premier Dan Andrews and Lisa Neville have both consistently been present on social media and providing media updates. They've been, you know, clearly keeping across a whole variety of issues. And I think, again, what's distinctive about this disaster is there have been a huge variety of issues that get raised when you have what's really like a humanitarian crisis, you know, when you have so many people cut off, people in need of water and fuel and food, both on the South Coast and in Victoria. You need people who have quite a lot of experience. So I think Victoria has been fortunate that we did have a government who, as you say, witnessed the 2009 Black Saturday fires.
And I think that the public have also changed in their response as well, that when, you know, the state government is actually telling you, oh, cut your holiday short, it's not because they're having any fun, it's because it's quite serious. And people did respond to that and got out of the areas en masse. So what are some of the broader implications for this? Do you think the religious freedom legislation is going to go forward, or what's your thoughts?
I think it would look very strange for Scott Morrison to bring that legislation forward in the near future before bringing forward legislation to deal with climate change or, you know, some of the matters that have been raised by this. It might be something that they attempt to put through in kind of a sneaky way, but I really think that a lot of progressive parties in the parliament and the independents will see it as incredibly cynical to put through divisive legislation like that. That, as I was, I think, kind of alluding to before, really is like a solution in search of a problem.
Yeah.
Like, there has just been no evidence cited that religious discrimination is a serious issue. And to be frank, like the resolving of the Israel Folau case, and I know that some people were unhappy that he got a payout, I think perfectly demonstrates that it's actually not a problem in this country. So Israel Folau has really not been discriminated against in any way. Like, yes, he lost his job, but he has been paid out handsomely for that. It'll be, I think, as well, because that case will now be out of the media, that in a lot of ways there will not be a natural poster child to keep that bill on the agenda. And again, in terms of the larger implications, climate scientists and a number of these reports have been circulating on social media are now beginning to flag that actually this bushfire season and a range of other information and data suggests that actually the level of warming we are on track for is much higher than we'd anticipated. You know, this year Australia's average temperatures were 1.5 degrees above the norm. So we definitely as well locked in at least a degree of warming. And it's happening very, very quickly. And I think a bunch of people who might otherwise have not been clear on why they should care about climate change or think about it, there's not been any escaping the smoke. There has not been any escaping. I don't think there'd be an Australian who has not been affected by the fires. You know, I have like dozens of friends, I've family members who lost or almost lost homes. I live in the inner north in Melbourne, in Fairfield, and we had a fire quite near us. Now, it wasn't out of control, but one just a couple of kilometres north in Greensboro did get out of control and thousands of people were evacuated. So I think people are going to need to see some pretty serious leadership from the federal government. Whether Scott Morrison's capable of providing that, I really don't know. He just yesterday was at Kangaroo Island. and was speaking to some locals, and this was caught on video, where he said, well, at least no one's died. And, of course, the locals said, well, two people have died.
Oh,
two
dear.
People have died. He later claimed he was referring to bush, you know, firefighters and not ordinary people whose lives still matter. But there have now been, you know, at least a dozen really tone-deaf moments where I don't think the way Scott Morrison has conducted himself, and for all this line kind of gets repeated a lot that it's, you know, just lefties on Twitter or it's a bubble thing. I really don't think that kind of stuff is, you know. I actually think for leaders in moments of national crisis, showing leadership and empathy are just core parts of the job. And I really don't think it's clear that he has those characteristics.
Yeah, I think we should end on that note.
Absolutely.
Toby, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.